Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Sign up to our loyalty programme and reap the rewards at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Discover a healthcare team that's always here for you at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Good morning, you're very welcome to the show. Before we meet our panel, let's have a look at some of the front pages. You'd be tempted to think that there's a little bit of, it's an ill wind and all that. There's a little bit of political coverage for the government now in this 30% tariff threat. So the Sunday Independent headline is Minister flags tough budget after new 30% tariff threat. Neil Richmond, Junior Minister at the Department of Foreign Affairs, says, given these uncertain times, the latest and continuous flurry of demands to empty the state savings funds for a range of one-off and current spending ideas are even more irresponsible. And that is kind of, it's echoed around the place. The Sunday Times, EU leaders urged Trump to revoke 30% tariff threats. And the first paragraph from that on the Sunday Times is ministers have warned of the devastating impact of President Trump's threatened 30% tariffs on goods sold into the United States from European Union member states from August 1st. Business Post, road to disaster is their take on it. Ireland and EU reel as Trump threatens 30% tariffs. There's an interesting line in that there where Neil MacDonald of Ismay saying the downstream supply chain for pharma is absolutely massive. Our people would tend to trade with a lot of these firms. You've got the man and van services, electricians, plumbers, food suppliers, raw material suppliers. So, you know, it's not just the people working in these places. Like, they can be the centre of local economies in places like Ringaskiddy and other places in the West. The Irish Mail on Sunday is leading with that dozens of prisoners in jail for serious offences, including a killer and a criminal convicted of a murder threat, are being temporarily freed to ease the overcrowding crisis in our prisons. And The Sun on Sunday, three uneasy, and a great picture of Katie Taylor there. And Katie confesses, they say, she might be tempted back into the ring for a dream homecoming at Croke Park. OK, our panel today, Nisha Dolan is a novelist. Gerard Howland is a former government advisor and Irish Times columnist. Tanya Ward is from the Children's Rights Alliance and Peter Brown is from Bagot Investment Partners. Good morning, everybody, and thank you for coming in on this lovely sunny day. Nisha Dolan, there are pictures in the papers of people enjoying the good weather. You're not one of them. You're writing in the Sunday Independent today that, yeah, and I will just, can I describe to people what you're wearing?
Yes,
you're wearing a black polo neck. Yes. You're practically smoking a jetan. I'm wearing a beret as well. So you're a summer naysayer.
I would say on the level of policy, I am not a climate change denier, but on the level of my personal decisions, I am. I refuse to acknowledge what is happening. I'm not going to change what I wear. I'm not going to change what I do. I'm disgusted by the whole thing and I want no part of it.
Really? What's wrong with the weather?
It's un-Irish. It is un-Irish to have this much brightness. We don't need it. We don't know what to do with it. Our skin can't absorb it. It gives us cancer. I am appalled that this is happening.
Yeah, you point out in your piece as well that we wouldn't have done many of the great things we do if we hadn't been sitting around in the dark trying to entertain ourselves.
This is it. We have a rich storytelling tradition precisely from the sheer lack of entertainment. You put us in a park, our IQ drops. The cylinders just aren't firing in the same way.
But is it not nice for us to be lightened up from our big, heavy brains and our centuries of generational trauma now and again and just be like Mediterraneans who don't live for the day?
Well, I know plenty of traumatised Italians, so I don't think it's necessarily the cure that we would like it to be. We lie to ourselves. We pretend that the sun makes things better. It doesn't. It makes things sweatier, and that's a different proposition entirely.
Gerard, are you enjoying the weather?
I am. And Nisha's spoken about her black turtleneck and the issue of sweaty. Could I talk about the string vest? I think it's a much underestimated garment that's gone out of fashion.
Really? Yeah.
Yes. And I would advocate it for people in this hot weather.
But it's neither one thing nor the other, is it?
I couldn't disclose on air.
Why do you need a vest if it's going to be a vest full of holes?
Well,
you could just go without a vest, or
you
could, or wear
that'd
a vest.
Be very radical.
What's with the halfway house and the string vest?
Well, I suppose it is the halfway house. That's the whole point, Brendan. You don't take the full plunge of taking the winter vest woolies off entirely. You have some degree of modesty. You have those holes for air and all the rest. And certainly, as children, we were all put in and put out in our string vests.
Of string vests, yeah. I suppose Rab's.
Do you think there's going to be a movement?
Finish it off.
Vest? No, possibly not.
I'll tell you. So the first golf course that I joined, they had a meeting for the new members, and the captain said, "We don't have much of a dress code in this course, but string vests and O'Neill shorts are not allowed." And I love the weather. Right, I play golf up in Staxtown, and from up there you can see the mountains of Mourne on a day like today, and it's just spectacular. So I just we don't get a lot of it, right? But I'm definitely out there. I think it's fantastic.
Okay, Tanya, you've picked Luke O'Neill in the Sunday Independent. Forget sunbeds and even sunshine. If you want a tan, there's only one safe way to do it.
Yeah, I mean, he's basically trying to encourage people to stay away from the old sunbeds, and unfortunately we have an awful addiction to them in this country. I just wish they would be banned. But look, I'm one of those people that worry about when it is really sunny. We have an awful tendency to, you know, the string vests, but the amount of people that are out in the bikinis walking around.
Not to their own advantage.
maybe not. But like, I have memories of growing up.
Yeah, we're not shaming anyone now, though.
No, but look, I have memories growing up in the 80s and early 90s, and like any time there was a sunburst, you were thrown out the door, no sunblock. And the amount of times I was sunburned around that time and period. So I think this time around we have a different attitude to it, and we know exactly what's happening when we go out. But yeah, I mean, I do worry a bit about what's going on, to be honest. And even in the current week, I was on a few meetings of people on the continent, you know, and they were saying that one woman was in Switzerland, and she said people pulled their kids out of school and brought them into the workplace because there was air conditioning for the week. So this, you know, the heat wave worries me a bit. I know we're all enjoying it in one way, but yeah, the other side of it, I do worry about what's going on.
I was watching Channel 4 News last night, the night before, and their coverage of this, I mean, I know that we here do cover, like, we cover the nice side of it and then the more worrying side of it. The coverage over there is grim. They're on their third heat wave of the summer so far, and they are deeply concerned about it.
And it's children and older people that are very vulnerable to heat waves.
Speaking of getting sunburned when we were kids, Nisha, you've that line in your piece, don't you, about the fact that, is it that the reason for skin cancer of the current generation, did you mention that?
It might have been in the piece that Tanya mentioned.
It's probably in Luke's piece that there was a heat wave, I think, at some stage in the 70s, and that it is the cause of, because I think the biggest issue for skin cancer is if you got badly burnt as a child. Yeah. Anyway, we could talk about the weather all day because we're Irish, but there are many other things going on in the world. Peter Brown, the Sunday Independent editorial you've picked, Trump knows how to make threats but not deals.
Yeah, so kind of, I think Trump is like a child who's recently discovered a swear word and is using it continuously because of the reaction they're getting out of it. The minute he mentions tariffs, he's headlines on every newspaper in the world. For a narcissist, that just must be nirvana, right? So I think he just uses it as threats, and he doesn't really follow through. He hasn't done, he's negotiating with 200 countries. The only deal he's done so far is a cut some tariffs with China and a deal with the UK. That's it, out of 200 countries.
He's done a deal with Vietnam.
He did a deal with Vietnam.
And actually, I was reading about the deal with Vietnam, and it seems that nobody in Vietnam knows what the deal is.
Yeah,
there's a 20% tariff rate, right? But there's also 40% for what are called transshipment.
Yeah.
And this is, Vietnam has become one of those places that people were moving some of their production into to get it out of China, Apple, Nike and Samsung. But they don't know what the 40% means. So like, it seems there's a deal done, but they're all sitting there scratching their heads in Vietnam going, well what are the tariffs on any of this stuff that's being, you know, semi-manufactured here or whatever.
So if we look, like the US imports about $4 trillion dollars worth of stuff a year. If Trump settled for a 10% tariff on everybody, he'd raise $400 billion. If he goes 15%, he'd raise $600 billion. That'd be a huge win. So I actually think that's where we're going to go in the end here, is 10, somewhere between 10 and 15% for everybody eventually. Right. But once he's getting the headlines and sticking the things and it's there at nighttime going 30% in the EU.
So you're not worried about this 30%?
No. And looking at a market's perspective, there's a volatility index in the market which measures fear. Right. It's the fear index in the market. It's at completely benign levels. Completely.
Yeah, but if the market thought right, are the markets right?
No, like they're not. They're not always right.
Jamie Dimon and lots of other people saying during the week that the markets are gone way too complacent on this.
So there's a theory that they've gone way too complacent. Now there's a balancing item in the market that the market's looking at, and that's a peace dividend. If we get peace in Gaza and get peace in Russia-Ukraine, we could have a serious rally here, right, in terms of a peace dividend over a number of years. So that's on the other side, balancing the scales a bit. The markets might be too complacent, but the reality is if we settle at 30% tariffs, we're going to have a recession of biblical proportions. So the markets just don't believe that. I don't believe that either. I think there's enough people behind Trump to say, look, we're not going to do 30. Let's get him to do 10, 15, and we'll raise ourselves $600 billion. So, and we've got a deal.
As I understand it, the current effective tariff rate across everything in the US is at 15% already.
Yeah.
Kind of giving the lie to the notion that Trump always chickens out. There is a fairly high level of tariffs now compared to what there were under the previous administration.
Yeah, but I think nearly everyone would agree that the US was being taken advantage of, you know, and that's kind of, I think people would go, if it's 10 to 15,
really,
would you? I think so. I think, I mean, there's a huge amount of people did trade there. It was imbalanced. The issue with regards to the US paying for the majority of NATO, all of those issues. There's a realization that America, okay, since, you know, they go police the world, we need to balance up our relationship with America. So 10 to 15, I think everyone would sign for that.
The only thing with the approach is it's people on low incomes and ordinary people that really suffer. Because at the moment, and this is probably the real reason as well why Trump probably won't go for the 30%, if you look at the tariffs that have been imposed, so it's an extra $50 billion that he's managed to raise. The truth is the American companies have mostly paid the price of that. So the person who's shopping in the supermarket hasn't quite felt it yet, but they will. And remember, he's introduced loads of cuts to Medicaid, loads of cuts to things like food stamps. All of that's going to bite very soon. And the American public opinion is not with him when it comes to the tariffs. You know, half of his voters are now saying they don't support the tariffs. They've worked out it's actually a tax on goods for them. And whenever you introduce a good global free trade system, when you look at it from the perspective of people on low incomes and children and young people, actually generally what happens is essential items become cheaper, things improve for people, quality of life improves. And even in the country where, let's say that's exporting, things stabilise there. There's better salaries there, conditions improve, you get better public services. So everything that Trump is doing, he's trying to undermine kind of food security, cost of living, these kind of issues that really matter to people. So I would say certainly you're going to feel, coming up to the midterm elections, all of this is going to start biting on Trump.
Jared?
So the EU has a slight strategic advantage in one respect over Trump, in that the EU cycle is longer. This commission, this parliament has 4 years to run. It's only 18 months to the midterm elections. It's 3.5 years to the next presidential election. That might be small comfort in the short term, but it's something to bear in mind the longer term. As Tanya said, Trump is already importing inflation into the United States. This is probably the worst act of self-harm since Brexit probably exceeds it. But while we can understandably be completely flustered about what he's doing and not knowing what he's doing, because he probably doesn't know what he's doing, there are some things we can do for ourselves. And I'm reminded of Micheál Martin said going into the economic dialogue, national economic dialogue 2 or 3 weeks ago, we have to control the controllables. So we already have a trade deal with Canada. We are in a very advanced stage of an EU-India trade deal. I understand in Brussels today will be a significant announcement vis-a-vis the EU and another major Asian economy.
Indonesia seems to be possibly.
Perhaps. Yeah. And then separately, we have Mercosur, which is EU Latin America on the table ready to go.
But which is being held up
because we're sitting on the fence
of beef. And yeah, like it seems like it's 1% of the beef market is what would be coming in through Mercosur, which doesn't seem like it would completely destabilised.
No, it's about one steak per person in the European Union. It would be massively beneficial to dairy farmers. It'd be massively beneficial to the Irish economy across the board. It needs to be done. This government, who says it wants to control the controllables, needs to get off the fence because it doesn't want to be caught still sitting on that fence in Brussels. This is something we need to do and need to get on with. And in terms of the bigger picture, and it is the bigger picture vis-a-vis Trump and the United States, this is really serious in terms of our economic model. We're going into an economic cycle here. We'll have a review of the National Development Plan. We will have a summer economic statement. We will have a budget. We will have a medium-term economic plan sent to Brussels all by the end of October. And those plans, unlike what we did for the last 4, 5, 6 years, have got to be realistic in terms of the very uncertain and less benign environment we are in now. There is not one for everyone in the audience. And that means there are consequences for domestic politics here.
I saw a stark figure during the week that we were, a couple of years ago, I think we were predicting roughly a 20 billion surplus for 2026. And the latest forecasts on that are 6.5 billion now. That's how much has changed in a couple of years.
And a sidebar of that diminishing surplus is our capacity to continue to put away money in the long-term sovereign funds that we've established, good thing, but only very recently, to provide for demographic change. And before they're hardly begun, we could be in difficulty fulfilling what we promised ourselves we would put into them because of those declining surplus.
Nisha, you picked Richard Curran in the Sunday and Ireland can't afford to dismiss Trump's 30% tariff threat.
Yeah, because I think from an Irish-specific perspective, what this really illuminates is how foolish we were in making ourselves a US vassal state and becoming so economically dependent on the whims of one country. Because fine, when there's a president who's affectionate towards Ireland, in the short term it works out, but when there isn't, and when we're just treated like any other nation, according to the US's interests, we are vulnerable to these shocks, especially when it comes to pharmaceuticals, which the article highlights. Lots of places outside Dublin.
But it has made, it has transformed this country, being, as you call it, a vassal state. Like, if you look around Europe, look at our nearest neighbour, Britain, and look at the standard of living there and the standards of everything and compare it to us. Like, we're in a different league to most European countries.
On paper, on per capita income on paper, but in practice, most people my age are living with their parents. So I don't think that translates to real quality of living.
Yeah,
okay. Well, sorry, could I just come in there, Nisha? You're right, the under 30s are in a really bad way, and I can totally accept that. But the point is, they are living with their parents. Previously, my classmates emigrated. That's a big difference. You may be living with your parents, you probably have a job. I'm not saying that things are not very tough, but they are quantifiably different.
I mean, and the UK, I think, is a bit different because it's not just about they don't have US investment. It's also they made very bad decisions to sell off all their assets and slash all their benefit payments and public services, the NHS, education, all the things that made them great.
But because they don't have the money to do it, because they're having to make hard choices that we're not having to make.
Would we agree on the
fundamental that this country is... This is a completely different country to the country I grew up in.
They made different decisions. And you're right, because the decisions we made, the investment, the foreign direct investment has transformed us without a doubt. But the decisions the UK made, consistently they made poor decisions through austerity, which has meant they have some of the highest levels of inequality in the developed world. We're not there because we've made better decisions along the way.
OK, so that brings us on to... the cost of living. Peter, Daniel Murray in the Business Post, economic uncertainty abounds, but pressure mounts for a bumper budget.
Yeah, so look, we know the cost. I mean, the headline inflation figure is very misleading. It's way below 2%. But we all know when we go shopping, things like that, the prices are rising, especially food commodity prices are rising. And there's very good reason for that, right? There's demand-supply imbalances, there's tariffs, there's energy costs, wage costs. Low real interest rates. Low real interest rates are a huge issue in Ireland because people get no return in the bank, which tempts people to spend 165 billion worth of retail cash sitting in banks, earning nothing. right? So people are tend to buy a house, people tend to spend. We've got government stimulus right across the board. Germany's going to do a trillion. Right across Europe, there's going to be government stimulus. There's going to be increased spending in defence. So everything we see is inflationary. Everything we see is inflationary. So I believe that inflation is going to start to come back and rise back towards 3%. So there's no, we've very little control over that. To control inflation.
So we're not coming out of, like we thought we were coming out of an inflationary cycle.
I think we're going back into an inflationary cycle, right? I think everything points to that. Everything points to that. Tariffs, everything you can see points to going back, where inflation's going to come back. There's nothing, there's not a lot of things you can do about controlling inflation. I mean, to control inflation, you really want to create lower consumer demand, which is a recession, really. That's not going to happen in Ireland with the amount of wealth there is around. That's just, it's just not going to happen. So we've got to be very careful, as Jared said, in terms
of
how we spend.
There's not going to be a recession.
There's not going to be a recession in Ireland. I don't see it.
There'll be a recession for some, though.
This is the point I'm going to make.
Like, is so, it's not. What's the old thing? A recession is when your neighbour loses his job. A depression is when you lose your job. Like, yeah. is there going to be a recession for people who lose their jobs through all of this? People are already struggling with the cost of living and inflation.
There's going to be a recession for people who are already struggling, and that's why when it comes back to the budget and the surplus, right? It's very important this time round that they target the right people. They don't give people with, you know, 500 million quid in the bank energy credits and stuff like that. Yeah. That's just ridiculous, right? Yeah. So they have to target, really be very, very careful where they spend any surplus we've got, that it's literally targeted at the right area,
yeah,
right? There's a load of people that don't need an energy credit. Right. Yeah. And that's really important. And this political idea of let's give it to everybody, it's good
for
both.
They seem to say there's practical difficulties in working it out. Tanya, you'd be a big advocate for this, which I think is gaining greater currency again now, this second level of child benefits. So the people who are getting it already, they, from the millionaires down, would not lose what they're getting, but that you can target at children in poverty.
That's right. So let's say these would be parents, maybe they're on CETA welfare payments or they're on low pay, and you'd get a second tier payment every month that would help you with the cost of living. And of course, you could up it and increase it depending on what the economy and the country is actually going through. I mean, what was really striking to me looking at the coverage, there was an article by Wayne O'Connor from the Sunday Independent, why the weekly shop got so dear. And what's really outstanding here for me is you have no choice when you're wheeling your trolley around the supermarket. So if you're walking around with your child at the moment in the supermarket, and generally what people do when there's inflation, they avoid buying the product that has gone up. So we know, let's say beef, some cuts of beef have gone up by 50%. So you might go, right, I'm not going to buy beef if there's a deal. So you might go, okay, what I'll do, I'll try and buy fish, frozen fish instead. Here you can see in a 2-year period, Dunnycough catchfish goes up by 20%. You might say to your kid, okay, no, look, we'll go for the bachelor's baked beans. It's gone up 42%. So your choices as a parent when you're trying to actually make your budget stretch, it's actually reducing all the time. And there's steps the government can do. I mean, there's definitely a need to look at consumer protections with some of these developments taking place.
But what kind of consumer protections? Like, we have a competitive supermarket sector where they're all like in a constant price war and deals war
with each other. Yeah, but some of the big companies in the middle are making huge profits in terms of what's going on at the moment. And the government
you say the companies in the middle,
some of the big multinationals are making massive profits.
The supermarkets.
The Unilevers who are selling us our ice creams and that kind of stuff. Kerrygold making huge profits in between as well. I mean, government can do more work to expose the cost of what things are costing and publishing profits. But you could be ramping up some of the powers of the Consumer Protection Authority as well. But the other side...
To do what?
Well, I mean, you go into a bit more detail to check what's actually behind the pricing of products. And people make complaints about these things and they've said they don't have enough powers to do a bit more investigation and exposing. But the other side of it, as you say, is through welfare payments. You can help families with the cost of living by getting to the families that need it most, the families who are on low pay, the families who can't afford to pay their heating bill, the family who is in dread wheeling the trolley around the supermarket. So this government, what it can do is introduce a second tier payment, as you say, for child benefit recipients.
Okay, Gerard, You picked out Simon Harris's interview with Mary Regan today in the Sunday Indo, and he's saying on this, I do the supermarket shop, I get it, but I can't say I'm part of the squeeze middle. Fine Gael, back to what Peter was saying, Fine Gael do not seem to be minded to be targeting things. Well, the way the dynamic that's been set up for us, the narrative is that Fianna Fáil are more for targeting things to the less well-off at the moment, but that Fine Gael are like, we want to mind the people in the middle. He's talking here again, Simon Harris is, about, you know, there are people who are working and doing well, but they are struggling and all that.
So no government really has made any hard decisions since about 2016. Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael, regardless of what any of them say about anything at any given time. Their manifestos before the last election, which is only a few months away, were riotously spendthrift. Their programme for government is less so, thankfully, but it's still, it's a miasma of all sorts of things without any clear focus. Simon Harris's interview today, he talks about third level fees, he talks about childcare, he talks about asylum seekers and they having to pay something towards their accommodation if they're working. I don't have a problem in principle with that, by the way. But incidentally, this is the funny piece, they're all things that are under the remit of Fianna Fáil ministers. Now, I don't want to be cynical.
Okay.
But to move on, there's something not in the interview, and I don't draw anything particular from it, but he didn't mention his previous hot topic, which was getting the 13.5% on hospitality down to 9%. That was not mentioned today. I'm not drawing anything from that, but I noted. What I will say is that if we're to talk, go back to what Tanya said, targeting those most in need, which I absolutely agree with. Before you spend, you have to have a sustainable tax base. And the first most important thing we have to do is stop doing stupid stuff. So stupid stuff...
But hang on, right? And I asked this same question last week. Is it insane and actually wrong for a government who has done these giveaways for the last few years when there was an election coming up, when affordability is clearly... For a lot of people, the only political issue right now, for the government to be continually telling people, no, you're fine, actually, we're not going to do anything for no special measures for the cost of living this year.
Every special measure for the cost of living in recent history was a one, or actually in several cases, a two for everyone in the audience. It's grossly wasteful. It should never have happened in the first place. It should never happen again.
And you're absolutely right. Right, and of course, one off things that are described as one offs are never one off. It's like if you get a bonus at Christmas, you think that's your salary next year, and you have it spent before you get to next Christmas, and then there's no bonus. One offs, you know, everyone now is expecting energy. When it comes to the winter, we're going to get energy supplements, things like that. So they really have to draw a line.
We saw with the college fees. People assumed that was forever. Turns out that was a one-off or two-off.
So they need to change the narrative. Need to change the narrative, Tanya says, to focusing straight into the people who need this, because it is getting expensive, who need it, and stop giving it to people who don't need it.
I mean, what I picked up from his interview was, you know, he's going to focus on public services, and that would make sense, because even when you poll people on middle incomes, that's what they want. They want to make sure that when their parent is sick, they go into A&E, there's someone to look after them, and they're not stuck in the trolley for long periods of time. I tell you what I would have liked to have heard from him. Very reasonable to expect asylum seekers in a job to pay towards their accommodation. But there was nothing about, let's say, asylum seeker children who are in direct provision at the moment. The only group of children that the country has given no increase in welfare payments in many years. And like, we have accounts in the Children's Rights Alliance of children eating sugar to deal with hunger in the direct provision system. They actually have a payment they raise funds for in over two budgets, and they never implemented it for those children, a very small group of children on the lowest incomes in the country.
Okay, Gerard, quickly, because we want to go to Nisha.
Seeker, who's paying a few bob out of your small wages towards your accommodation, fair enough. But if you're a student who's going to get a lifetime advantage in terms of job and opportunity, why shouldn't you pay fees? I think you should.
Absolutely.
Okay. Nisha, back to the cost of living. By the way, this was up on the Irish Times website this morning, so you know, maybe it was in the paper in the last few days, maybe it's new. Dennis Drennan of the ICMSA, right? You know, we've heard this thing, the era of cheap food is over. He's pointing out that previous generations spend twice the proportion of their income on food and that we've really been living in la-la land about food prices for the last while. And should we all know, 49p carrots and discounters and all that kind of thing. He said it is a fantasy that to think that we can change the nature of farming, say, to low emission sustainable farming, change the whole system farm to fork and everything, and bring in astronomical costs into it, and to think that that's not going to affect the price of food. And he is basically said that thing, the era of cheap food is over. But Nisha, you picked a piece in the Sunday Indo, butchers fear they will die out as cost of meat soars by 50%.
Yeah, because I think it's a drastic failure of political communication that we haven't emphasised that climate change and the cost of living are the same issue, and that as the conditions in which we grow food, for example, become more and more hostile, prices are going to rise. And so our reliance on the meat and dairy industry still is becoming less and less efficient in a carbon-scarce world.
Dennis Drennan would make the opposite point, that the fact that we are making farming more sustainable costs a lot of money.
Well, in the short term, sure. But the reason that we're having to do that is because oil is becoming more and more expensive. The old systems are becoming more and more expensive. And of course, changing that is costly. But so is proceeding as we are. It's going to be ruinously expensive to live the current lifestyle in a decade.
Well, we could pay the ultimate price. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Peter, you're shaking your head.
No. Well, oil isn't becoming more expensive. Oil is becoming very cheap. Energy costs in general, right? Gas and things like that are still very high compared to pre-COVID. But oil is very cheap. Oil is $65 a barrel. That's at the lower end.
So why are energy costs so dear?
Gas energy costs are dear, but I think it's more
sustainable
labor.
Energy is
labor.
Pretty dear as well, is it?
Sustainable
even
energy.
Even though you think it would be free.
Yeah. No, sustainable energy is expensive. There's a lot of costs feeding into what's farming doing. There's a huge impact in Ukraine in terms of commodities, right? There's a huge impact in terms of labour. I mean, the labour costs are up, you know, the minimum wage is up substantially. So there's a lot of cost in there. And I just don't, I agree with the article that food overall as a percentage of your budget is much lower, but rent and all other things are way higher.
Yeah. Right?
You know, so people still struggle. But I just don't think there's any argument that the cost of living is coming down.
Okay, food's not getting cheaper in the near term. Okay, I want to get on to the real burning issue of the presidency. We will take a break first. Nisha Dolan, Gerard Howland, Tanya Ward and Peter Brown staying with us. Welcome back. Our panel still with us. Nisha Dolan, Gerard Howland, Tanya Ward and Peter Brown. So, the presidency. So we had Niall Quinn thrown in the ring yesterday by Miriam Lord. And I've also, Gerard, have you heard Paddy Bonner or Mary Kennedy mentioned in terms of Fianna Fáil?
I've heard nearly everyone.
Brendan.
And perhaps even yourself in due course. But I think the best coverage, by the way, in the papers today by the president's the cartoon in the Sunday Times.
Yeah.
Which both for a laugh and for a good insight by Constantine, I would recommend anyone to look at it. So all sorts of names are bubbling up. We know what Fine Gael will do. We know what the Sock Dems have decided. Labour are meeting Catherine Connolly during the week. And we do not know, and I suspect they do not know themselves, what Sinn Féin and Fianna Fáil are going to do. I don't see another candidate coming from the outside without party support who will get a nomination to get on a ballot paper.
Okay, so we have two in and yes. Then potentially a Sinn Féin and a Fianna Fáil candidate.
Correct.
So we're going to have a fairly a largely establishment
or a
old school kind of presidential election.
Or a proxy for one or the other.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so what about you picked this piece, Tumult Within Fine Gael at No Contest for Irish Pick, as FF's Martin urged to run. This is in the Sunday Indo. So basically, to the first one first, are Fine Gael unhappy at the Mairead McGuinness thing? Are some people unhappy?
Well,
and is it wise of them to be, you know,
no,
out
it's not,
so early
no,
with
no,
just one acclaimed candidate by acclaim?
Well, they never had more than one candidate. The Sean Kelly, he would have been, I think, made a presence at a convention. He's a very formidable campaigner. Was it always going to be Mairead McGuinness? I think yes, and I think that's the reason he's not contesting. So she's a de facto candidate and has been for some time. In relation to Fianna Fáil, they're really in a bind.
Why is this Micheál Martin thing gathering more steam now? Are there people in Fianna Fáil thinking that We actually maybe now have a viable successor. We won't favour anyone in particular with that, but someone who looks like a viable successor, are they thinking, is this a handy way now of easing Micheál Martin out?
There could be, and I remember the 1970s when Carol O'Dolly resigned and people in the parliamentary party who were not unassociated with Charlie Haughey gave Jack Lynch every encouragement to run. So that is politics. Micheál Martin would be a great president. He would be a great candidate. Nobody's unbeatable, but he would surely start with enormous strengths. I think it's very unlikely he's going to do it.
OK, Tanya. The Mail on Sunday, John Lee, SF choice to run for president will be one of its top three women politicians.
Yeah, he's suggesting, and he always is a good source from Sinn Féin, it's either Mary Lou or Michelle O'Neill or Lynn Boylan. And the decision hasn't been made yet who's going to run. The preference they seem to be pushing for is Lynn Boylan because, you know, if it's Mary Lou or Michelle O'Neill, the problem is they're going to lose two of their key leaders who are really important to the future of the party. And Lynn Boylan already has, you know, she's run a lot of campaigns. She's a big Dublin vote. She should be proper from that perspective. And she's been very outspoken when it comes to Palestine and housing and some of the issues that are really going to impact young people and some young people who might be voting for the first time. You can imagine Lynn attracting that vote as well.
Is there, I won't say a danger, is there a chance this presidential election becomes about Gaza?
I mean, I definitely think so, because, I mean, a lot of us are very disturbed about what we're watching. There's a genocide taking place, and you look on social media, you see it every day.
So there's an unprecedented context to this coming presidential election in which the international environment, including Gaza, including Trump, that Ireland's place in the world will be in, you know, up for grabs, up for talk. Really, in some respects, in jeopardy, up for question, up for decision in a way was never in any previous presidential election. So the international context will feature in this one in a way I don't think it ever has in any other.
Yeah.
Okay, so you think it could be about Gaza?
And other things.
Yeah.
But Ireland's place in the world,
yeah,
the president's role,
yeah,
and the president's role is very clearly defined in the Constitution in relation to international issues.
Yeah, but never mind that. It's defined at the moment by Michael D. Higgins. So does that mean that if you end up, say at the moment, you have a continuity Michael D. Higgins candidate, roughly, versus a Eurocrat establishment figure, roughly, does that benefit the Michael D. Higgins continuity candidate?
If that took off, the answer is yes. But if you don't mind my saying, Brendan, I do mind that. I think it's really important what the Constitution says. I think it's exceptionally important that nobody except our elected government decides on Ireland's place in the world. That our elected government is not preempted by a president whose role it is not to set Ireland's position on this or that. It doesn't matter if you agree or disagree with them. What matters is who has the mandate that we give as people. This is not about the president versus the people. It is about us, the people, having the capacity to hold our government to account, which we can when the government acts, but which we cannot when the president acts preemptively.
But I suppose the president can reflect.
Really important.
But I suppose the president, in reality, can reflect a mood in the country that maybe doesn't express itself through to conventional politics,
yeah.
Nisha.
And even just as a reflection of their integrity and their past record, I think you can consider what they did politically, not necessarily with a view to wanting them to do more of it as president, but just as information on their character and where they're coming from. And the fact that Mairéad McGuinness, for instance, was defending Ursula von der Leyen last year, I think Irish voters can take that into account as a reflection of her politically without necessarily wanting her to interfere beyond the president's remit.
But equally, Tanya, as soon as, say, if Mary Lou MacDonald walks into the Oras, she stops being a Sinn Féin representative straight away then, doesn't she?
That's right, and I suppose, and the thing is, she has to win, otherwise she'd probably have to step down as Sinn Féin leader. And look, she's going, if it's Mary Lou, and remember, these opportunities, they only come up every 7 years, you know, you have to make your decision to jump or not. She'll be a formidable candidate in this election, but one of the things that is interesting, I think, about the Irish president, if you think about the last three presidents, Higgins, Robinson, and Mary McAleese, they've actually all been strong human rights advocates. And you can see why names like Nolene Blackwell and Kieran Gallagher have been circulating as a potential for some of the parties.
Why don't we have a government full of human rights activists then?
We don't elect them, Brendan.
Yeah.
Well, but look.
So go on. What's the difference?
The difference is
like it's nice to have them there in the arts.
And in fairness to Tanya, there is definitely more support and concern, and that's why there are more people in the Dáil with a particular emphasis on those issues. But we, the people, when we go to the ballot paper, elect our TDs, we tend, by and large, to elect people with a different emphasis. It's not that they're anyway against supporting human rights, but it's not necessarily their primary emphasis.
So it's back to the heart and the head, maybe.
But a lot of people that put themselves forward to be elected, actually, usually they've been in public service, actually, is really. Mm. There's only a small number that'll be human rights campaigners. And there's a few in the Dáil, you know, who have that background.
Yeah, yeah.
Rory Ahern and Sinead Gibney. But actually, by and large, I think the people we elect are people like teachers, doctors, you know, they've served a particular role in their society and they want to go into politics because they want to serve the public.
Nisha, you picked in the Sunday Times, Ian Begley has a profile of Catherine Connolly, Galway girl who aims to step out of Higgins' shadow.
Which is a hilariously condescending title for two reasons. First of all, are we still referring to grown women as girls in 2025? And second of all,
I suppose he's referring to Galway girl.
It's still not a good look, though, is it?
Yeah.
And I also don't know if it would be considered newsworthy the two people from Dublin had similar politics. So that aside, though, I like the framing of her as a politician in the article. It deals with some criticisms of her that had come up before then, but I'm very fond of her, I have to say. She's, first of all, she's very strong in terms of the Irish language, and one thing that stands out for me, I spoke at a lunchtime protest outside the Central Bank over there permitting the Israeli war bonds prospectus, and she spoke at it too, and there was basically zero political advantage to doing so. It was a very small protest, but she showed up, and that's the kind of president I would like. So I think she is very much spiritually a successor to the admittedly irreplaceable Michael Dee in that sense.
Okay. Peter.
Yeah.
In terms of world affairs, which these days means a lot of war, you picked Barry O'Halloran's piece in Sunday Indo, Trump may finally see Putin for what he is, a mafia don with nukes. So yeah. Trump is getting a bit more impatient with Putin.
The light is dawning here on Trump that Putin. See, the difficulty with Putin is he doesn't have any worry about how many soldiers he slaughters, how much his people suffer. It's very hard to negotiate with somebody like that. He just doesn't care, right? And that's the Russian history. They were the same World War II. How many soldiers got killed didn't matter. Doesn't matter now. So when you negotiate with somebody like that, he doesn't have a downside. He's not going to get kicked out. He's not going to get overthrown. And he's not worried about
this
the carnage.
This talk about that he only has a year left of propping up the economy with a war?
No.
On a clock?
No, I don't think that's the case either, right? So he's the only negotiation with Putin is what does he want, right? And unfortunately, the only answer to that is to make the Ukrainians sacrifice something substantial to appease Putin. And that is the only way I see this conflict being resolved. And I think Trump understands that now. I think he understands that now, that the negotiating on the Putin side is a waste of time. You have to negotiate on the Ukrainian side, putting pressure on the Ukrainians and saying, look, we can't support this forever. This is the deal you're going to have to do. And that's how that's going to get resolved. It's not pleasant, right? But that's just the way, the only possible solution to that conflict.
Do you agree with that, Gerard? I saw the foreign minister, or ex-foreign minister of Ukraine saying that in 2023, Russia had taken 18% of the territory of Ukraine. 2 years on, it has 19%. Mm. It's paying a huge price for really incremental gains, like, isn't it? So Russia is not winning here.
No, it's not winning, but I would say retreat is impossible. And that's the problem for Putin. He's not a man with either a retreat plan or a retirement plan. And that makes him very dangerous. And it's how do you contain this, stand up to it, and not conflate it into something even bigger and worse. And all we can do, I think, is to support Ukrainians to combat Putin on the ground, to seek to contain this as long as possible.
But does Crimea and maybe parts of the Donbass, do they ultimately get handed over back to Russia?
Well, so ultimate could be a collapse on one side or the other. That's exactly what happened in World War I when you had a stalemate for years. One side effectively collapsed. Will one side or the other collapse in Ukraine? Or if not, is there eventually a negotiated settlement of some kind? I have no answers, Brendan.
Yeah.
All I can say is that with somehow, and this is important for Ireland, an important part, I suspect, of our presidential debates, that Ireland needs to be part of Europe that's supporting Ukraine. That's uncontested among our proposed, suggested presidential candidates.
Tanya, to Gaza, you picked an interesting piece by Ed O'Loughlin in the Sunday Indo. Without social media, Gaza's agony will remain unheard.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose we're often very critical about social media and the impact it's having on children, young people's lives and us as a whole, really, to be honest. But I suppose Ed O'Loughlin is kind of singling out really actually the role social media has had around Gaza. And I suppose this genocide that's taken place is under our watch and we can see it every day, actually, is the truth of it. And it's because of social media. People in Gaza are posting all the time about what the effects are. He singles out a few different comments from people there, but one that really touched me was from one guy, Anos. You know, each day in Gaza is a survival test. Drones above all day, smoke clouds the sky, nights haunted by fear. I mean, that had echoes to me of the north, to be honest, because people would talk about some of those kind of experiences when they lived through the conflict. And I suppose in a way he's a bit hopeless because he's talking about how the media have actually been covering what was going on for a long time in Gaza. And at the same time now it's for all to see. And I mean, certainly I am sensitised somehow to children's body parts in a way I'd never been because I can see it on social media every day of the week. And I suppose one of the things I suppose to think about, it could be you could feel very hopeless, but I would say don't, actually, to be honest. At this point in time, there's obviously the Americans are trying to negotiate a peace agreement. To be honest, there's not much in it because if you look at what's happening at this moment in time, the Israeli government is actually building what looks like a concentration camp beside the Egyptian border.
This is the so-called humanitarian city that they're insisting
right
on.
Right beside Rafah. So they have no plan for ending the conflict. In fact, they've kept it going because Netanyahu wants to stay in power. There's no talk about a new government, no talk about rebuilding. I mean, 60% of it is gone. It's been there's no buildings left. Half their hospitals are gone. There's nothing like that. Nothing about elections and new democracy. Actually, the only talk is about trying to force them in beside the Egyptian border, whereby they will then push them out into Egypt. It's Nisha. Actually genocide, ethnic cleansing. That's what's on the cards. The only thing I would say is I think we have to be hopeful as well, because what the former Prime Minister of Israel has been out and he's been saying, Ehud Olmert, and he's been saying that the most important thing now, because there is a kind of Israelis, a lot of them are turning against Netanyahu. Some of them feel they just want it to end. But he thinks international pressure at this point will make the difference and will force the Israelis to come up with.
Yeah,
a
Nisha, on that, you picked a piece by Gabrielle Weiniger in the Sunday Times. Troops defy call to corral Gazans. And it does seem as if, like, Israelis, we were told for a long time they weren't seeing anything that was going on in Gaza. Maybe back to social media, as Tanya was saying, it does seem that Israelis are becoming more aware and more exercised.
Yes, and in this case, not even because of social media, it's a 28-year-old soldier in the army who, along with a couple of friends in the reserves, hired lawyers to petition the High Court to rule on whether international law was being violated. And I think showed extraordinary courage and moral clarity in doing so. Now, I do think you could fairly argue the only ethical thing for anyone in Israel to do is just leave Israel and not be part of the system in any way. I would have a lot of sympathy for that argument too, but within the position that he's in, I think it's an admirable thing to do and does illustrate that the reality of being on the ground. Because the other thing that struck me is that he wasn't against it at the start.
I'd be careful about saying that any right-thinking person should leave Israel because, like, notwithstanding what's going on at the moment and not excusing it in any way, Israel's right to exist has been threatened for a long time by all their neighbours. So I think the idea of telling Israelis they should leave there is, let's just be careful around that.
I'm not going to tell anyone what to do.
Yeah.
But right now there's no threat. There's no threat. That's what Olmert has been saying. He said, we've taken out Hamas. There's no Hamas left. There's only very junior people left. There's no threat from Iran. And in fact, how they've managed to stay in power, people like Netanyahu have managed to stay in power, is the threat, is the fear, is telling the Israelis, we have to do this to survive. And actually, there is no threat anymore.
OK, Jared, before we leave this.
Yeah, I mean, I think Israel, in its own self-interest, will bitterly regret the Netanyahu years. Israel is being hugely changed internally. And my big regret about Ireland is that there's no sensitivity here to the diversity of opinion within Israel. We just don't want to know, we don't want to hear. But opinion in Israel will be extremely important in achieving progress. And we need to be better attuned and better in touch with that diversity. And to be clear, I believe Israel has a right to exist. It has a right to defend itself. It had a right to defend itself after the 7th of October. But this has gone way too far. In a way, just be really selfish about it, in a way that's damaging Israel.
Yeah, yeah. You feel at this stage it could take Israel generations to recover its
standing. And the internal quality
in
of its democracy is diminishing all the time.
Yeah.
As a consequence of this government.
OK, we'll take a break. Neisha Dolan, Jared Howland, Tanya Ward and Peter Brown staying with us. Just to note that there are a few texters saying that the under-30s are emigrating, Jared, but just one quick one here. That I'd say people will have noticed this themselves. Recession. Have you seen the cars that are travelling the roads of Ireland? Tank-sized 4x4s and SUVs, black Mercedes and BMWs. I saw two different Porsches in Kilkee last week. The Irish want everything. We've learned nothing from 2007. Will that be a moment that there'll be letters to the Irish Times? I saw two Porsches in Kilkee. Is this a record? Will that be a moment people will remember as a high watermark? Okay, Neisha, tell me about Louise Eccles piece in the Sunday Times about teenagers treating bots as imaginary friends.
This made me overwhelmingly despondent and sad, but above all, it strikes me that this is just a new development in what I think has been a much longer process of us losing the concept that friendship and relationships require reciprocity. And so I think before the mass rise of ordinary people using ChatGPT, you got a lot of this in online discourse, people talking about, I don't owe anyone anything. It's my boundary if I don't want to text you back. It's my boundary if I don't want to show up for your birthday party or whatever.
Yeah.
And so I think it's natural now that people are turning to something that they don't have to give anything back, something that's just serving their every need and pandering to them. It also reflects, of course, a breakdown in social support, that people feel the need for this, the teenagers feel so alone. And so I have sympathy too, but when did we become so selfish? And I don't think it was before ChatGPT. I think ChatGPT is enabling it.
Is it not like this is an age-old philosophical question, hell is other people, that we really only become a full person in relation to our relations with other people? But it is very hard. Other people are difficult and tricky to relate to and everything. So, like, you can see how if there's a bot there, it's not going to challenge you in any way. It's not healthy, but...
Yeah, but we grow through the fiction. Like, when I'm editing something, I try to imagine my worst enemy reading it. My worst enemy who has good literary taste, because you're going to get a much more honest read on your strengths and weaknesses than if you are dealing with a sycophant. And ChatGPT is an automated sycophant.
Tanya, you were looking at that too. Mark Little mentioned here yesterday, I actually know someone who does this, that young people are using ChatGPT for therapy.
Yeah, I mean, it does worry me, to be honest. And I mean, even the article, because of some of the findings, 12% of the children said they'd no one else to talk to. The most common question, what should I do if I'm cyberbullied? How do I handle pressure to fit in? Like, you can just imagine what's going on for the young person at home who's using ChatGPT. And look, the problem with using something like this is you're not talking to real people, you're not making real connections. And I think there is something kind of sinister about, you know, some of these AIs actually presenting themselves like a real person, because the way the tech platforms operate is they want to suck you in when you're young, because if you engage very young in all of these platforms and products, you're more likely to have, you know, brand loyalty all the way through into adulthood. So it does worry me, and I think we do need to look at the role of AI. We need to actually be focusing on with children, young people, about actually this is what it's doing, because God knows what it's saying back. That's the other thing, you know.
Yeah, I worry we're too late.
Look what Grok said on Twitter, like, you know, like, you know, around around Nazis and anti-Semitism, like, very worrying.
They've dialed down the political incorrectness. Yeah. There are three Porsches in Carrow Row, by the way, just to keep us updated on the Porsche situation. Listen, before there was social media, there were things that brought the world together, Gerard. The Business Post today has a piece on Live Aid 40 years on. You remember Live Aid?
I do, and it was, I remember Bob Geldof, he literally bounced. He seemed to be bouncing on the stage. It was a magnificent occasion. I suppose in one way you could be cynical and say it faded, but actually things really changed, because in terms of governments, foreign direct aid, these things have become institutionalized, widespread.
Well, it was Geldof who then socialized Bono into going off and
Bono socialized George W. Bush. So things have changed. Africa is a growing economy, place with a lot of problems, but things are not the same. They are different, and I believe that was an instrument in making that difference.
Yeah, and of its time, we'd all agree. But at the same time, look, what isn't of its time?
It did good, and good has lasted.
Yeah, and one person did good. I mean, I think it's really proud. Moments in the 80s where one Irish person was able to have such a massive
contrary
impact.
Bollocks. did all that extraordinary. Okay, thank you very much to my excellent panel today: Anisha Dolan, Gerard Howland, Tanya Ward, and Peter Brown. And it's just 12 noon now, and we'll go to the newsroom.